welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And unfortunately, or actually, good fortune has fallen upon Tammy because she's not here with us today. And that's just because she had an unexpected surprise of some close family swinging by. And so completely understand. It's always a blessing having family in our lives. So, as I always say, that debt is fraud. And in your appeals to heaven, if you want to organize a prayer circle or a prayer group or what have you, just let us know. We'll post it on Reclaiming the Republic's Red State Talk Radio podcast page. And with that, I also want to say that your campaign needs to begin today. Now, before I get into the next, or, you know, transition from the last EO to another EO that was passed just this week, or actually just last week, I kind of want to express the importance of recognizing champions and leaders. Now, a leader versus a manager does the right thing. A manager does things right. And so in respect to when we're looking at politicians, nine times out of ten, now, there's these different classifications of how I would see a politician. One would be a demagogue, and a demagogue makes complaints about the system, says this is all wrong, this has got to stop, but they never lead on a, you know, tangible solutions. And as a matter of fact, you know, it's just get me in and this will stop, you know. In America, the majority of the political campaigns are demagoguery because it works. There's nothing hotter than somebody making a big issue about the economy. There's nothing better than somebody making a big issue about the invasion, what have you. So we allow ourselves to be driven by the problem instead of demanding clear, articulated solutions. And so I'm just frustrated. The reason why I'm just going to go down this rant is it's more of a byproduct of frustration. In working with candidates, in working with people who, you know, whether I'm mentoring, whether I'm working with them directly, or whether I'm not. And I'm seeing these politicians that are out there, and it just makes me sick when I hear them talk ambiguously. They don't, and we have clear conversations. We talk about the problem, and all they want to do is give you double speak. They want to have an inquisition. They want to, you know, dive into this. Let's open the discussion. When it comes to what government can do, it's not open for discussion. It's either enumerated or it's not enumerated. When we're dealing with non-enumerated powers, it makes me sick to hear somebody, well, you know, maybe we should be talking with these guys and... And I get, so if you are a candidate and you are looking for my endorsement, the only way I'm going to endorse you is, one, you have to sign this pledge that we have, and two, you actually have to lead on the Constitution. You actually have to demand compliance. That may seem like demagoguery, but it's not. Because bottom line, when you undo, because when we look at the majority of our problems are stemming from what? Unconstitutional behavior, unconstitutional powers, unconstitutional property, unconstitutional roles, responsibilities, so forth and so on. And so I think it's very easy for a politician to stand up and say, this is unconstitutional. It's got to end. This is unconstitutional. We've got to dismantle this. They've weaponized this one thing, and it's even unconstitutional. It shouldn't even exist. How hard is that? How hard is it for a person to become a champion of the Constitution? It's not that hard. And as a matter of fact, the best way that you can actually do your quote-unquote campaign is using these petitions. I mean, we created these petitions for people to actually initiate a campaign on the Constitution, because these petitions demand compliance. They demand that the federal government dismantle all of its unconstitutional treaties that they had no authority to create. It demands that we end this invasion and actually repel the invaders. We demand that the unconstitutional powers that have been assumed since the efforts of assuming the Department of Transportation way back in the early 1800s, that was the first power grab that Congress had gone through. And even though they couldn't get the Department of Transportation, they were able to create the Department of Home years later on their own, because by that point in time, there were really no barriers for what the federal government can do. When we look at how great this nation could have been had we maintained a vigilance in understanding the Constitution, it's not that there weren't efforts of that. And as a matter of fact, Tammy and I read that letter of 1821 where a group of men wanted to actually get Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. It was a letter from Madison to John G. Jackson. Go back and look at that. Last year, it was in December sometime. And it was clear to Madison that it didn't matter what the notes, what was stated and how the men understood it at the Constitutional Convention. What mattered is how those men went into the states and explained the Constitution, answered their problems, and set the terms and definitions of that Constitution to the states. That's what mattered. That's why Madison stated that it didn't matter what we thought. The only thing that matters is how the states understood the Constitution at its time of ratification. When they bought into it, how it was sold is the only thing that matters. Now, we've also covered documents throughout the year last year, and we're going to cover those again, that Madison clearly points out that you have to use the ratification debates in understanding the Constitution. Why is it that the federal court system has failed to even pick the ratification debates up? Why is it that they actually have created a crutch of the Federalist Papers? Simple. It was a tool to help them aggrandize their power. Hamilton deliberately polluted the Federalist Papers in those last several, seven or eight. I should look it up so I memorize the number. But from Federalist Paper that was dated the 21st of June on, I think there's like 7 to 10 somewhere in there. All of those were deliberately done to help explain additional responsibilities and powers of the judiciary that did not exist within the Constitution, which is why the jurists actually used that. And they say, clearly, we have this power. Right here, Hamilton pointed out in Federalist Paper number 81, that 81 was one of those Federalist Papers. So we need to actually start separating the wheat from the chaff. And I'm just so frustrated in spending time with people. And I'm so frustrated in people, you know, listening to politicians talk about how good their political theatrics are. Let me explain political theatrics. Political theatrics is a way of selling a compromise to we the people that they can actually do these things. And then they go get the court to support them. This is why when we look at all the travesties that have occurred, the court is right there at the center of it. Now, there needs to be a thorough scrubbing of the judiciary, a thorough scrubbing, because there is a very, very dangerous paradigm that is existing in our system today, our legal system today, because there are lawyers and judges who believe they have the power to create law, to make new law, to take existing law and change it to fit our world today. That does not exist within the constitutional powers. I don't think it exists in any state constitution, and I know it does not exist in the federal constitution. So therefore, when we look at the dangers that the judiciary is laying upon us, and we're dealing with Congress and the executive who fail to actually point this out, that only means that they want to continue, that's the best way to say this, they want to continue depending upon the judiciary to protect their unconstitutional behavior, or they don't care about fixing the problem. Now, I know, and I'm not ashamed or afraid of somebody saying, hey, you still hate Trump. I don't hate Trump. I don't necessarily hate Biden. I hate everything that these guys have done that have been wrong. Biden has never cared about doing the right thing, and that is a travesty. Obama, the same thing. Clinton's the same thing. So when we look at what they are doing, then I have to question why. Why is it that they don't point out these problems? Now, in the previous executive order, and I know Trump doesn't listen to me, but I know a lot of people do. And in going through that previous executive order, where we talked about the changing of the citizenship, and the standards and going back to that, I pointed out how Trump failed to call out the court for violating the separations of power. Trump needs to, if anything, he needs to actually lay out and end, first challenge and end the court's ability to create, change law, or redefine the Constitution. They do not have that authority. It is not in the Constitution. It's in the Federalist Papers, which is why, in those last few Federalist Papers, which is why we clearly need somebody to stop so that the powers delegated to the court are restored to those limited and defined powers. The powers delegated to Congress are defined or go back to those limited and defined enumerations in the Constitution, which we find in Article 1, Section 8. And the executive actually enforce the Constitution and challenge those laws that aren't constitutional. Just because a president down the road didn't veto, I mean, we really dodged bullets when Madison, Monroe, and Andrew Jackson vetoed these improvement bills for the transportation system, the bonus bill, the Cumberland Gap bills, and so forth. And so we dodged a bullet because these guys did the right thing. Had they actually passed those bills and they signed those bills, had one of them actually signed them and said, yeah, I'll allow it, that doesn't mean today that the president today has to abide by those unconstitutional laws that built off of that. We don't have to allow that to happen. But more importantly, see, Trump can't dismantle these things. I mean, he's looking at FEMA, and FEMA was created by Jimmy Carter in an executive order action. So, and actually, I think he actually had Congress's system in it. Doesn't matter. It's not an enumerated power, unfortunately. And I think that's a good thing that the federal government is not given the power to basically do any welfare, any bailouts, any type of assistance for natural emergencies or what have you. Now, it's one thing when we're getting attacked for defense purposes and so forth. Absolutely. They have a responsibility of federalizing the militia and actually deploying them to where the militia is needed in either one of three things. These are the things that they can do. Execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and or repel invasions. They don't have the authority to pull out the militia or bring the militia forth and, you know, provide aid and comfort to, you know, these victims of a hurricane, tornadoes, floods, earthquakes. And I know that there's people suffering and they need the help. This is for the states to do. The states have the power. The governors have a militia. And there's nothing wrong with the governors being able to utilize their resources to help each other. I think that's what you do in a marriage. That's what you do in a union. But to get this child to say, let me do everything for you, and I'm going to assume these powers as they rub their grubby mitts, it is only opening a door for them to basically subjugate the states, the sovereign states, the union, the parents. And it completely perverts the relationship between the child and the parents. So as we dive into, and what I want to do, because I'm still frustrated. I'm still frustrated that we can't shake these creatures that are we call politicians. I really enjoy dealing with a politician that wants to get things right. They listen, they go and do the research, and they actually start standing up for doing the right thing. I will tell you, some of these people that I'm really frustrated with that are pursuing their leadership positions or their political positions, there's no way that that person, as conservative as they are, as good as the heart that, you know, bleeds red blood and claims to love the Constitution, with their mouth they do honor it, but with their heart they have removed it far from them. And so had we not had Wes McCart actually recognize what needed to be done and did it in Stevens County, we wouldn't have this example. Had we not had Frank Ethorn, the state chair of the Republican Party in Wyoming, we would not have had a Republic Review Committee in Wyoming for the past 6 years, since 2018, 7 years. So, because I believe, yeah, it comes up on November this year, where we have the 7th year anniversary. And so I'm here to tell you folks that when we get leaders like Frank Ethorn and Wes McCart, these are people that really want to do the right thing. And, you know, I tried to challenge Wes to get back in to do something to challenge more. And it's not like he's not wanting to do that. That is atypical, I would say, of a good person that really wants to do the right thing. But it takes a lot of work to try to wrestle and wrangle people. This is why we need to start getting more people into the game, because it's kind of like a bad marriage. When you have one spouse dragging the other spouse down all the time, it weighs on you. Or one person that is hostile, one person in your life that is, it doesn't have to be marriage. It can be in a relationship. It could be a friendship. It could be a team, a work team, a social team, where somebody wants to be hostile and they want to be controlling and they just want to basically cause havoc or stress. Those types of things weigh on you. And it's not uncommon that people just bail. They just walk away and say, you know, I'm done. It takes, I think, a real, maybe an idiot, but I think it takes a super good-natured person to constantly forgive. And because in some ways, like marriage, and in some ways in your relationships in politics, you don't have a choice of who you have to work with. Like Trump, I mean, Trump has to work with Congress. He has to work with the Supreme Court. So he doesn't have a choice on that. I mean, he may have the ability to kind of reshape them a little bit, but he doesn't have full control. And there's many a times as an employer or as a leader, manager, whatever you want to call it, in my profession, there are many times that I've walked into and said, okay, here's your team. You've got to, you know, take this team and go do good things. And you don't get a chance to, you know, create an all-star team. You get the team you're given. You get those folks you're given. And I'm here to tell you that it's a lot easier to lead and basically help people transition and have, even though it may be painful to have difficult conversations, to get people to recognize, you know, how they can improve their contributions, blah, blah, blah. It is painful to do that, but it's even more painful to actually let that person leave because of the domain knowledge. Sometimes you have to because they're just so toxic. But a lot of times you absolutely need to keep that person because having to bring a new person in and have them develop the domain knowledge and everything else, it puts you back so far that overcoming some of those gaps is very difficult, especially if it's a domain that is not a simplistic domain. I mean, anyway, I digress because I've actually taken the whole first segment of ranting on this. Now, the executive order that I want to dive into is, let me see here. This one is the guaranteeing the state's protection against an invasion. And so this is one of Trump's new executive orders. And just like the last one, as we looked at and we pointed out how they failed to call out the judiciary, in this one, it wasn't necessarily calling out the judiciary. This is in the very first substantial paragraph. It basically says this: the Supreme Court has recognized the inherent right and duty of the executive branch to defend our national sovereignty, stating that when Congress prescribes a procedure concerning the admissibility of aliens, it is not dealing alone with a legislative power, it is implementing an inherent executive power. Now, I find it interesting that all of this meat to discuss right here is in this one little phrase, because the Supreme Court doesn't need to recognize, the states recognized. And because the states have recognized, the Supreme Court, Congress, and the president would recognize the separations of power and the inherent powers of all three branches. Why? Because the states created them. They are basically the children, or I should say, you know, when you have a child, you have a single child, right? But when we created the federal government, it was like triplets. And they weren't identical twins. There was one twin that was very superior, had far more powers than the other two. And that superior twin in this triplet birth is the legislative body, Congress. Congress has the most all the powers. That's why Congress is center in the Constitution, Article 1. Look at how many pages, how big Article 1 is in contrast to Article 2 and Article 3. Because what they have to do is that important. And what they're capable of doing is that important. Now, when the Constitution was ratified and the states, well, I just realized I'm going to be going into a break real quick. Ta-da. So when I come back, I will revisit this concept of when the states created the federal government and when they created these limited roles and responsibilities for Congress. It was expected that the other parties, i.e. the judiciary, would recognize this and they would stay within those bounds. And we're going to talk about John Jay and how, well, we'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, as we stated before, when the states created the federal government and the Constitution, or I should say the delegates for the states, and then they ratified it, they all agreed, and keep in mind, Madison pointed this out several times, that the Constitution was justified on the limited and defined powers. In other words, the triplet that was created, the big mighty triplet, the most dominant triplet, was Congress, because they were the ones that had the power to create the laws regarding those delegated powers that they could create laws for, such as taxation, to pay for these laws and regulations that they needed to do or they needed to conduct and they needed to maintain. And so if we kind of go through some of these, it's right here in Article 1, Section 8. Now, they have the right to borrow money on the credit of the United States to spend on the following things. Remember, the preamble to the Constitution, the preamble to actually Section 8, not the Constitution, to Section 8 basically states that Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, impost, excises, to pay the debts and provide for the basic defenses and welfares for the Union, and I'm paraphrasing, all duties, imposts, and excise. This is the uniformity clause, and this is a hard requirement in this preamble. All duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. Okay, so that means anything that the federal government is going to do, they have to make sure that they don't create advantages or favors towards any state or disadvantages or disabilities for other states. And they've been doing that, creating disabilities, for a long time. So they have this responsibility of borrowing money. They have the ability to regulate commerce with foreign nations and with the Indian tribes. And they have the responsibility of regulating commerce among the several states. They do not have the authority to regulate the state's commerce within them. Only to make sure that the states, again, they want to make sure that all the states have the mutual benefits of free trade amongst each other. So the trade, so, and that's one of the reasons why the states are restricted from creating these these pacts, trading pacts, you know, to create advantages for themselves. And what ended up happening is that's exactly what they did. They violated the uniformity clause when they started going after the South because of slavery. And that was done because the abolition movement was so frustrated because the Constitution was violated by Monroe and Congress by passing the the Missouri Compromise. I want to make sure I you know, could easily say Monroe Doctrine or what have you, but the Missouri Compromise created or empowered the federal government that mandated slavery upon states underneath a very specific geographical latitude, all unconstitutional. So it started frustrating the design of the Constitution because slavery was actually supposed to be phased out. The Constitution, which is why the Missouri Compromise came into play. they knew they had to force slavery upon states, or they would not have this balance that slavery would actually become extinct in America. And these little states, these few states in the South, did not want to see that. Plus, they were creating these franchises, and they were making a lot of money. These families were becoming very rich. So they also have this responsibility, and this is the key, to establish a uniform rule of naturalization. This does not have anything to do with immigration or the importation of people. The only place where immigration... So when a person wants to come to the United States, do they come to D.C.? Is that where everybody wants to go? Nobody wants to go to D.C. except for those people who want to broke power and corrupt our government and do bad and evil things. I mean, D.C. used to be a hallowed place. It used to be a place where men were actually trying to do what was good. And even though it got corrupt within the first 10 years, D.C. originally was, and this whole concept of this, these three children that were being created by this Constitution, these triplets, was to serve and support the Union and the states. And it quickly got perverted because of Hamilton. Bottom line, as I go through all of these things for the coining of money or creating standards and weights to provide punishment for two laws, for counterfeiting coins and down the road to define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against the law of nations. Those were the only criminal jurisdictions that were given to the Constitution to the federal government. Okay, and treason. They had the jurisdiction over treason against the United States. So that's it. And we covered this in the Kentucky Resolutions, how they've assumed so many other laws that they have no right to. Anyway, establishing post roads, promoting the arts and sciences by securing, not by actually giving money to the arts and sciences to do research or what have you, but to promote it by securing copyrights and limited exclusive rights with their respective writings. So in other words, the trademarks and copyrights, by allowing them to have limited trademarks and copyrights, to declare war, to raise armies, to have a navy. I mean, the rest is national defense. And then at the very bottom is where they list the property. So you see, folks, the only thing that Congress can really create laws on are these very few limited things. The only thing that they can compromise are right here in Article 1, Section 8. They have responsibilities in other articles and in other places in the Constitution, but none of those are powers that they have this responsibility of regulating and creating things. And therefore, when we look at the big, or I should say the most powerful triplet, it had this ability to do these very defined things. The next powerful triplet was the executive, because the executive had power to negate law, to veto law. He had the responsibility of executing the laws of the Union, was the commander-in-chief when the federal militia was actually deployed. He would decide what plans to be executed and do. And then the judiciary. Now, remember I said going into break, I was going to talk to you about John Jay. The judiciary was very limited. They only had the jurisdiction over cases that arose under this Constitution. In other words, if it is the roadway, if it is the environment, if it is oxygen, if it is healthcare, if it is energy, if it is labor, they have no authority to be involved in it. Now, what about the Bill of Rights? Does that create this portal for them to start creating this labyrinth of lies and rules? No. What happens is if somebody had a right that was discriminated, let's say your right to actually petition government or your right of religious worship was being hampered, their responsibility was saying, yes, that right has been hampered. But they don't have the right to issue a law. They don't have a right to actually say, thou shalt not teach creation anymore. The question regarding the Scopes trial and them deciding that evolution was more appropriate to be taught in the schools than creation was not their job. Even though the Bill of Rights says Congress shall make no law respecting, that didn't mean, because the only reason it mentioned Congress is because Congress was the only entity out of the three, out of the triplets, it was the only one that had the power to create law. Why would they have even considered the president, Congress, and the judiciary shall not create, make law that will abridge blah, blah, blah? Why? It wouldn't have made sense. And actually, had they done that, then it would have actually lent to this concept that the president and the judiciary had lawmaking powers. Instead, they focused on how it was that only Congress could make law. Isn't that interesting? So, John Jay was a part of the Supreme Court. And shortly after the government got started, they said, you know what, we need an emissary to go and try to create a treaty regarding the Mississippi. And because John Jay was a let's say he had a good reputation in the dealings with Britain over the war treaty. And so they asked John Jay if he wouldn't mind stepping down temporarily from the Supreme Court. They would replace him. And they would have him go and try to work out a a treaty with Spain over the Mississippi. And I think Spain, France, you know, all the countries involved. And so, interestingly enough, it was a fiasco. He came back and he was insulted. He was no doubt injured by the insinuations and the comments, and he was basically shamed in the public eye. So he kind of retired back to New York, and what ended up happening was, I think it was Washington that basically called upon him. He goes, hey, I think you'd still be a great, you know, servant on the Supreme Court, and I'd like to call you and ask you to come back. John Jay said no. And his comment wasn't because he was insulted or anything else. His comment and this, the justification of why he said no, was because the Supreme Court was really a dead-end job. They had, you know, if all they could do is rule on whether the Constitution was being violated, whether somebody's right was violated or not. I mean, they couldn't create law. And so he just saw that the Supreme Court was just a placeholder, a seat that would occupy some jurist to basically make a decision on whether the Constitution was violated or not. In other words, he didn't see any glitz or glamour. The Supreme Court was going to be a very boring job, death by paper cuts. So when Marshall got appointed because of Hamilton's basically, you know, suggestions to Adams, then, I mean, Adams was played by Hamilton. And so, and Hamilton, I could just see him as one of those flattery, you know, soothsayers that, oh, you're so great. You're such a, you're a better president than Jefferson could ever have been. You know, those types of things. I could just see him saying those things. And so Hamilton convinced Adams to get Marshall onto the bench and become and give him the Chief Justice position. And so in so doing, this is when Hamilton winked, nodded, and handed Marshall the Federalist Papers to say, because the conservative mind by, I think it's Russell Kirk, he points out how Hamilton and Marshall were not only friends, Hamilton was Marshall's mentor, and Marshall was his protege. In other words, Marshall learned everything he knew about subverting the government because, and Hamilton told him, use these bloviating opinions. Even though you won't be able to create law, down the road your opinions will. Because he knew that once this ship, or once these twins, you know, the triplets, have, you know, traveled far enough down the road where there had been enough people that had died off, they would have the privilege and ability to actually start donning new roles and responsibilities and powers, because nobody's there to actually stand up and say, read the ratification debates anymore. Hamilton basically planted, and even though he died just a couple of years after Marshall got into the seat as the Chief Justice, even though he was dead, Marshall understood the plan. Use the Federalist Papers as the primary document for understanding the Constitution and defining the Constitution. And down the road, and I'm sure it was such a maniacal plan that they probably had highlights, or they at least had these steps that down the road, once we get to a point, and I think Marshall actually retired in the 1830s. Late 1820s, 1830s sometime. So I think by that point in time, Joseph Story, who was, I think he became the Chief Justice at that point, he basically started to put the plan in motion where they started using precedents and case law. The Constitution gave no allowance to precedents and case law to allow precedents to stand. Each case was to be judged by the merits of the case, that they were not to actually be able to start creating case law and then start creating this labyrinth of, because of this decision in this case and these decisions in this case that support this and create this paradigm of that, well, we can actually create law now. That's how they were able to assume these things. So acknowledging the fact that the federal government even started violating the Constitution right out the gate, it didn't really change and assume greater powers. It just started doing things that it didn't have the power to do, like a bank. And we talked about this with the Alien Sedition Acts of the Kentucky and Virginia Resolutions and so forth. When I dove into those, you could see how Madison and Jefferson saw this as a personal attack on the people, that we the people were being attacked. Even though the bank was wrong, unconstitutional, they didn't find the merit in organizing the states to stand up against the federal government in doing that. And I think that was just because, you know, it was not that it wasn't a big deal, because actually Madison and Jefferson spoke that this was wrong. These are infractions. They didn't make, and they should have. Well, not that they didn't, though. To be clear, they were very consistent in standing up on what was constitutional, what wasn't constitutional. It was Hamilton that was bending, perverting, and literally implicating all sorts of things that weren't constitutional, such as implied powers. So when we look at executive orders, because that's really what I wanted to focus on, when we look at these executive orders, we see that Congress has, and this is what's in the executive order protecting the states against an invasion. The Congress has, in establishing a uniform rule of naturalization, created a complex and comprehensive federal scheme in the Immigration and Nationality Act. Prospective immigrants, this is part of the executive order, prospective immigrants who use the visa system are screened for such health, safety, and security. In other words, the federal government is managing immigration now when they don't even have the authority. It's not delegated in the Constitution. And so as these prospective immigrants are screened and for security security concerns, as well as safety, health, and all these other things, while outside the United States, and are not permitted to enter into the United States until they establish that they are eligible to be admitted. Now, I told you a long time ago that immigration was a one-to-one thing. It was an action that the individual would apply. Right, wrong, or indifferent, it has been done to the federal government. The federal government really doesn't have the power to do this. The states really need to be managing, and I can understand the necessity of having this done centrally. If the states don't want to manage and have the burden of dealing with direct immigration, an amendment is required for the federal government to take control of immigration, period. And we want to make sure that they do not have the power to import people, because these refugees and these block grants of people coming in because they're from an area, because of, what do they call it, political... I know I'm going to get some texts, but when they grant favors because of, you know, political expediency, because a person is being harassed, or if you send them back, their life could be in peril. And so forgive me for not being able to come up with all these words, but bottom line is that they don't have the authority to do that. They don't have the authority to just say any person, political asylum. They don't have the authority to create political asylum for people coming into the United States, period. They don't have the authority to allow refugees to come in. The access coming into the states should actually be to the states themselves until the amendment is created. There is no amendment created. They assume this. Remember, I said this on Friday or Monday last week or this week, that there was no immigration policy after the Civil War. The standards of naturalization and actually allowing by the 14th Amendment to create citizenship for all blacks and Indians, all people that were born in the United States and under the jurisdiction thereof are citizens. That's what the 14th Amendment did. It didn't take people that were not under the jurisdiction that happened to be here, granting them citizenship. If they were born in a foreign land and they came here, until they naturalized, they could not be a citizen. Their children could not be citizens. We covered this. So in this particular act, in this particular executive order, the problem is not actually recognizing those limited and defined powers, responsibilities, and enumerations in the Constitution within these. It saddens me when we see an executive who wants to do the right thing, at least I'm giving him credit for that, and he's doing good things, perceivably good things, but he's not calling out those sins. He's not calling out the earlier transgressions where the federal government had done things. What he should be doing in this is he basically should say the federal government doesn't have the power to deal with immigration. They only have the power to deal with and creating a standard and establishing a rule, or establishing this concept of a rule, having a uniform rule of naturalization, period. That's what they do. This is the standard for anybody and everybody coming into America. And actually, the concept of having a uniform rule of naturalization where it favors Latinos or people south of America where they can come in, that is not uniform. Remember, the federal government cannot play favors at all. So, when we look at where this responsibility begins and where this responsibility is to be held, this is a state responsibility. And I would wish and I would hope to see and recognize the sovereignty of the states. That has to start coming up out of Trump. If the sovereignty is still going to be marginalized, if the state sovereignty is going to be maintained and marginalized by President Donald J. Trump, then he's not going to make America great. He is maintaining this unconstitutional power that doesn't belong. if we're going to actually start creating and getting back to the roots of our government the way it should be, then we have to start recognizing what the government has the authority to do and what they can't do, and that is to be left to the states. Now, if the states want to amend the Constitution, then we need to have those dialogues. I am here, and if I have to shout at the top of my head to heaven, please don't let these amendments come forward. Keep the federal government limited and defined to all things external. Now, I can, like I said, I can see this immigration being managed by the federal government. Would it be expensive for them to? It would probably save the states money because it limits the bureaucracy to one. But it has to be limited and defined in that Constitution. It's one of the very few things I actually favor the federal government assuming. But the states have to make the amendment and they have to ratify it. So I'm not a favor of giving them, you know, education, housing, all of these other domestic matters. Technically, immigration is an external matter. But the importation of people, no, they're not allowed to do that. As a matter of fact, it probably needs to be framed in the amendment that the federal government will have, they'll be granted the ability to be agents for each of the states, where the states will then commit to the type of people that they need to immigrate. And that then the state, the federal government, will have a uniform rule of naturalization that will be a standard that will serve the states. Remember, that's what's supposed to happen. The states are supposed to be served. Now, actually, I only have a minute left, a little over a minute. And I've had a lot of people get upset because I don't talk about this show is Reclaiming the Republic. I'm G.R. Mobley. I don't necessarily do that marketing. So I've received phone calls from people and I've received hate mail because I had to listen to your show for a whole hour and I suffered, you know, all your berating of Trump and, you know, and it took me all day to find out that, you know, who you really were. At the very beginning of this show, I identified that I am G.R. Mobley. And even at the end of the show, I really don't dive into that. And so you have to understand that I don't care about doing the marketing of who I am. I am actually trying to, because if I educate you, if you become the statesman, then we all can win. Your successes are our successes. The success in Wyoming is a huge success for America. The success in Stevens County is a huge success for America. It is not a GR success. And as much as some people want to think that, you know, this egomaniacal person here is just trying to make a big name for himself, I just need to point out that I get complaints. I actually get complaints with the fact that I am not telling you who I am all the time. I hardly do it. And I don't tell you, oh, Reclaiming the Republic, I'm not even an organization. We're a paradigm. We're a uniter. We're getting people to unite on the Constitution because that's how you reclaim the Republic. You don't reclaim the Republic by creating and building an organization. That's building an organization. We want to work with you. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email.
Thank you.